Well, for those of you who are unusually observant, you may have noticed that this one is given a title number 8, and the one we did last month was number 6. You may wonder what's happened to number 7. Well, it's being postponed until number 9 because I was asked to address the issue of conflicts of interest among IRB members during the month of September. I'm not sure there's some regulatory or something that means this needs to be done. So we will return to vulnerable subjects next time. We're starting conflict of interest this time, and we'll continue that for I'm not sure how many more sessions after we finish vulnerable subjects. We all know what a conflict of interest is, but I have found it helpful to put it in words so that we have a clear understanding of what it is we're talking about. It's when your professional judgment concerning a primary interest may be unduly influenced by a secondary interest. There may be two competing interests, but one of them takes priority. We all agree on what that one is, and your job, my job, is to ensure that that one primary interest takes precedence and is not dominated by the secondary. Now, that's different from an ethical dilemma. And I'm confronted with ethical dilemmas all the time in doing ethics consultations. Should we stop the ventilator or continue the ventilator? Should we do surgery on this handicapped newborn or not do surgery? There are two options, and we have to decide which is the ethically permissible or ethically better choice. But here, there's only really one choice. But our job is to ensure that that one dominates. And a conflict of interest is not a behavior. It's a condition. And recognizing that there's a potential for conflict of interest in a given situation does not apply any impropriety. But it accepts that there may be a perception of impropriety. We have to live with the fear of perception. And let's face it, the U.S. medical research community has a history of ignoring conflicts of interest in the past. Therefore, regulations have been put in place. Now, as you think about this issue, requires intellectual honesty. And almost everybody says, well, you know, I'm above that. I can figure out what's important and ignore the other things. But a good percentage of people are not convinced that their neighbor is as good as that. Interesting study that I footnoted here, done of medical residents, asking if they would be unduly influenced by receiving a gift from a pharmaceutical company. And only 2% thought they would. But 30% thought that their buddies would. So we perhaps are not as understanding about our own motivations and altruism as we might be. So what are the primary interests in medicine? Well, the health of our patients, research and education are the big three, and our obligation in any given situation depends on that situation. Are we treating the patient? Are we involved in research or teaching? And I might just mention as a tangent that when we're talking about people that are participating in research, they are not patients. They are subjects. And as I sat in and listened to this last discussion, the word subjects came up many, many times. The word patients came up many times, and we're really talking about subjects. And that may seem like a picayune point to you, but it really makes a difference in how we think about this endeavor. So what are the secondary interests in medicine? Well, I've sort of tried to alliterate them with Fs. The one we're all concerned about is money. So fortune, fame, getting your name in print, family, free time, other things may get in the way of your primary interest. And your role as an IRB member is to protect study participants from undue risk and to determine whether a proposal should proceed from an ethics perspective. Now, I put in there parenthetically, this is a controversial point, whether or not your role should include an assessment of the scientific validity. I personally think that that is a valid part of your role. If something really doesn't make any sense to do, then why put anybody to any burden at all? See, nothing of risk. We'll leave that for another day, but I think your role is primarily to protect subjects. So what's the societal, professional, governmental response to this concern about conflicts of interest for IRB members, or conflicts of interest in general? One is avoid them, either on a voluntary basis or sometimes a mandatory basis, or disclose them. And we're going to talk in a subsequent session, when we talk about different spin on conflicts of interest research, that disclosure may not be an adequate protection. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. And there are many possible conflicts of interest in research, but today we're going to focus only on those that you might encounter as IRB members. So what kind of undue influence might creep into your deliberations? Well, it can involve design, conduct, reporting, or review of the research. I mean, it's really pretty broad. And the goals of any policy, and I understand there's some mandate to have a policy that's really very exclusive and very black and white and very well demarcated. And the goal is to prevent conflicting interests from interfering with your review process. With your mandate to protect subjects or compromising the credibility of the review process. So if some research project goes really bad and it hits the newspapers and people start looking back and they see that there was a member on the IRB who's a spouse of the primary investigator, ooh, this is going to really raise questions. So the federal regulations that we're working under are very clear and very black and white. IRB members must not, that's not an option, must not participate in or be present during initial discussion or ongoing review for any research in which they have a conflict of interest. Now we're going to have to define what that entails, but this is part of federal regulation. The only allowance is that you as a member of the IRB can be present to answer questions in your own area of expertise, but not during the discussion, not during the presentation, not during the voting, excuse me. So on the back, excuse me, I'm going to get a drink. On the back, I've tried to address financial and non-financial conflicts of interest. And I started working on this before I had actually seen the regulations, just thinking about it myself. And didn't really have to modify it very much after I saw what the regulations had to say. The financial conflicts of interest really have to do with your relationship with the sponsor. So if you receive any significant income from the sponsor of a protocol, then you have to be excluded from the deliberation. Whether that's salary, consulting fee, speaking fee, being on a paid position on their advisory board, and others. Or if you have significant stock. What does significant mean? I'm not sure. But that's something that if you need to reveal that if the question comes up. Now, I think, it's been a while since I looked back, but I think that excludes mutual funds. But if you have specific holdings in a company that's sponsoring the research, that disqualifies you. Or if you have any intellectual property interest, patents, copyrights, trademarks, and so on, in the research or in the technology that is the focus of the research. So maybe you have a patent on a competing product, and so you might unconsciously, hopefully, be biased against doing this research because you don't want this research to move forward and be competition for your own your own product and so on. And I said a first-degree relative if an IRB member holds any of these positions. And the regulations actually go a little bit beyond first-degree relative and include at least everything that I consider first-degree, which would be spouse, children, parents, siblings, but includes in-laws and grandparents as well, and step-parents. So anybody who might be close enough to be an influence. Not that they necessarily came along and said, well, I want you to vote for this because, or vote against it because, but just the fact that they are there and you're aware of that and so on.
So you include ex-wives?
Probably, because you might be biased in one way or the other. Then the non-financial conflicts of interest have to do with relationships, really with the with the investigator. So clearly, if you are a co-investigator, that's clear, you can't participate in the discussion. But what about if you're a co-investigator on another study with the PI? That one's a little softer and a little less clear, but let's say, for instance, that I'm doing a study with one of you, say with Betty. We're working on something on research in nursing ethics. So clearly, if I bring a protocol here, she's a co-investigator, she has to be excused. But what about if we're working together on a project, and then I bring another protocol to the table having to do with family medicine? She's not really involved with that, but because of the professional relationship that we have, she might be biased either for or against my pursuing this other protocol, depending on how nice I've been to her in this one. So I think it's still appropriate to bring forward, if you are co-investigator on another subject. Another study. What if you are an investigator yourself on another similar study? Now I put myself in some different shoes as I thought about this. I have on occasion, I do reviews, manuscript reviews for several journals. And I have on occasion said, I'm sorry, I cannot review this journal because I know the author, if it's not blinded, or because I'm working on a manuscript that's really kind of similar. I got one several months ago from a very reputable ethics journal, and it was not blinded, so I saw who the author was, and she was a former student of mine. I just saw the title. I didn't see an abstract or anything, but the title sounded a lot like a paper I was working on. And I said, boy, I really shouldn't look at this. So I sent it back to the editor and said, I can't do this for these two reasons. And she pushed me a little bit. So just for curiosity, is it because she was your student or because you're working on a similar project? I said, oh, it's because I'm working on a similar project. When she was my student, I was very easily critical of her writing. In fact, I made her write some papers over because I thought they weren't good enough. So it was really the fact that I had this other interest. So, or if you are a relative of one of the investigators, or if the the PI has a supervisory role over you, or if you serve in a supervisory role or an advisory capacity for the investigator, and again, if a relative of yours holds a position described in any of these above. Now, one that I did not include but I thought about, and I just put it on the table, hopefully that you will voluntarily bring this up. If you have a business relationship with somebody, does that exclude you? I think it should. I mean, if I as a physician were practicing and our group held a 25% interest in an imaging center, and we were going to do and a partner of mine wanted to do a study, I mean, I would be biased in favor of that partner because of our financial relationship and so on. So, and the bottom line is that if any of you are asked to look at a protocol and you have any suspicion at all that there might be either a conflict of interest in your own head or a perception from anybody else that there might be a conflict of interest, you need to bring that forward, and it needs to be discussed before the protocol is actually presented. So I think in your handout you also got copies of the policy and some guidance from the AAHRPP and so on that you should keep in your files and so on. And I open it up for comments or discussion. Right.
There's no provision to declare, I have a conflict of interest, I'm going to vote to you all watching because I have a conflict of interest. So there's not that kind of thing. But just from an ethical standpoint, outside of the regulations, some of these are not regulatory.
Well, from an ethical perspective, I think there is. From a regulatory standpoint, it looks like they're pretty tight. And I mean, my bias is towards the tightness rather than the flexibility, primarily because of this unconscious bias that we're all subject to. So I think it's better to declare it to the IRB and then let the chair or the whole board, or I think you're supposed to have some kind of committee that discusses specific issues if it's not clear, if it doesn't clearly meet the guidelines.
An example of something where the declaration might be enough is listed. If you have a supervisorial status for this person. So when Dan Jung was here, he was the chairman of neurology, and by that rigid standard, you could never do any neurology reviews, at which point you wonder why you have a neurologist on the board. So it almost, if that were a rigid rule, you'd almost have to say no chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And then no chairman can submit a study and have it reviewed by anyone in their department by the same standard.
Or, as it is, with Dr. Jung on the board, I mean, you could ask him questions of fact, and he could be excused from the deliberation. But I think your point is valid also, that he has more expertise in reviewing the protocol itself than anybody else. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that same proximate level of expertise could be obtained from somebody who was not chairman.
Question about this questions of fact concept.
Mm.
Let's say that I'm here in a way that is conflicted, and just say I'm chair of neurology someday, and there's for questions of fact. It seems to me that there are times when the neurologist would know important stuff that the IRB wouldn't know to ask, but asking open-ended questions that allow him to say whatever he wants kind of undermines the whole point of the question of fact issue. So I'm curious, how do you really handle that in practice? Do you kind of
That's a good question, I wouldn't be uncomfortable with an open-ended question. Do you know anything more about this class of drugs that might affect how we look at this? I don't think that would elicit bias, consciously or unconsciously, if we're still talking about facts. Now, if you're asking him an expert opinion, that's a different matter. But
then my other question was, it says here under the Research Affairs Conflict of Interest Guidance Draft, the final point, 3, examples not generally considered conflicts of interest include IRB member, staff, or family member as research subject or potential subject in the study. I have an 18-month-old daughter, and I can tell you, I can't be objective about anything surrounding her health. Mm-hmm. How is that not a conflict? Why is that excluded?
Well, I think it is a potential conflict, and I think they have decided that it's not a necessary exclusion, but I would think it would be necessary for you as an IRB member to say, if this is doing research on a condition that my daughter has or and so on, that you have a potential conflict of interest. And if I were chair, I'd say, okay, we're going to excuse her from this. But it's just not mandated, but I think it's a valid point. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
I gotta leave.
The regs, although very explicit, after you get past the heading, everything in the text says financial conflict of interest, and they're very clear. They're very clear about financial conflict of interest. So it seems like the non-financial conflict leaves more room for managing the conflict as opposed to eliminating.
Well, I was given two sets of regs. One is just three lines long, and the other is a page and a half. And I don't recall that they excluded non-financial conflicts of interest. This is element 11, Roman numeral 2.1D. Oh, that's the written materials. Now, the only thing that I was given as far as the federal policy was this three-line thing that says, no IRB may have a member participate in the IRB's initial or continuing review any project in which the member has a conflicting interest, accept or provide information.
Yeah, so that would be 45 and
46. Right. So conflicting interest covers both financial and non-financial. Well, my limited reading on this, both in what was given to me and what I've been able to find in the literature, was that the federal regulators are very clear in not looking for management of conflicts of interest, but elimination.
We have it really good here. When I was in fellowship at NIH, the rule was you couldn't even own one share of a mutual fund that owned anything that had a contract with the government, nor could your spouse. So the elevator operator's spouse couldn't have a mutual fund. It was ridiculous, but that was the rule as implemented when I was there. It was just insane. Well, that was the point that was the pushback we tried to make.
You can pretty much reduce all of management to management of paranoia. So that, this is just one aspect of that. You know, there's a certain amount of paranoia that you're going to do something that's proper, and it's appropriate to have some limits. It's just that I always get a little bit nervous when they say we're going to eliminate anything, and then they give a definition that has tentacles that are, you know, 10 miles long, and you can't eliminate them. It's just what we do is we try our best. Everybody else is
I think that's a reasonable bottom line. Thank you for summarizing that.